Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Cercini.
I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
And I'm Tosin Onufuaken.
This week, the NSA stands their ground. Jay-Z's got 99 problems and his new album's digital distribution is one. Apple's App Store celebrates its 5th anniversary and you get the gifts. Dropbox remakes itself with DBX and a closer look at Grand Theft Auto 5. As always, you can check out past episodes of The Drill Down as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com, and our subscription link is in the right-hand sidebar. And join us on Facebook and Twitter at The Drill Down. Before we get into the headlines, we occasionally like to do a segment on the show we call What We're Playing With, where we talk about the gadgets, apps, and tech that has obsessed us over the last week. And I wanted to talk about a couple of things briefly here. A while back, I got a brand new camera, and it's the first mirrorless camera that I've ever owned, and really the first sort of full what would be considered DSLR, although technically mirrorless isn't an SLR, but more than just a point and shoot, because previously I'd owned point and shoots before, and this is the first one that I've owned that isn't a point and shoot. It's the Olympus OMD EM5. It's a mirrorless camera. I would say it's about 3/4 of the size of a Canon or Nikon camera. It uses the Micro Four Thirds lens system. And I have to say that the images that I'm getting out of this camera are just phenomenal. It's a whole different experience. If you've never used a DSLR or anything, you know, fancier than a point and shoot, it's like night and day. You can just achieve so much that you haven't been able to achieve. I'm very happy with it. I've got like some great lenses with it. I've got a couple of really good prime lenses, and I just picked up a broad zoom lens. It's I think it's a 1470 millimeter zoom lens, I believe. The prime lenses are so fast. I've been taking some shots at night. I thought I would need some sort of flash or some sort of external illumination to light up these shots, and they're just coming out great without any external illumination whatsoever. Just some great images. And perhaps I'll put a link to some of my to my Flickr gallery that has some of these new shots online, so you can see the quality of it, but I'm very pleased with it. You guys own any DSLR cameras or any sort of mirrorless?
No, I currently don't, but I always have this urge to get one after playing with the friends, just because the images you get are beautiful. Like right now I depend primarily on my iPhone. I have an iPhone 5, and in many situations, the images are definitely tolerable.
Yeah.
There's just something about like an actual standalone camera that's really amazing.
Yes.
I just don't know if I'm ready to invest so much since I'm not a huge photo taker.
It's a weird thing for me. I find that I used to have, I've never had a DSLR, mostly because I always have a close friend that has one, and when I want to go on a trip, I borrow it, and I treat it like gold, and I don't have to own one. It's one of those things. I've been looking at the mirrorless because they're smaller. The DSLR, the bulk is a big deal. And then there's this idea that the technology moves quite quickly for such an expensive device. So I always feel like I'm on the cusp of wanting to get one, and then I know, oh, something else is going to come out, and I end up getting pushed back, and I'm like, I'll wait. And then it shows up, and then I don't want to do it. So it's one of those things where I find I haven't been compelled. I used to kind of get the G-series type Canon point-and-shoots. It's like point-and-shoot, but it's raw. It's the precursor to the mirrorless cameras.
Yeah.
And then I found that the picture quality was good, but the fact of the matter is even that was too big for me. So I went for the point. I always had a point and shoot around, and then when the iPhone 4S came out, I actually took my point and shoot budget and I threw it at the iPhone 4S. I've since moved to the iPhone 5, and the fact is, when I went to my girlfriend and I went overseas for New Year's and Christmas, we went to India, and we used our phones for everything, and the pictures look great. I mean, are they the most clear, crisp, awesome, ridiculous pictures that you could get from a DSLR? No. Are they great pictures that we both enjoy and that our friends ooh and ah out? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I find that the best camera around is the one that you have on you at the time, and that's the one I always have on me. So my plan is to look into mirrorless now that it hits a price point that I'm happier with than the DSLRs, and you get great quality, and they're not very big. So I think it fits my lifestyle a bit better than the DSLRs and all that comes with them.
That was really the determining factor for me, is I wanted to get some DSLR type thing, but I didn't want the bulk. And with the mirrorless, you get rid of that whole mirror reflex part, and it's just you can make these devices just super compact. And I was hemming and hawing between the Sony NEX series and this Olympus, and I just figured a little bit of extra money, it's worth the investment for the Olympus, and I have not been disappointed.
Yeah, the one thing that I think I'm interested in, I think the next camera type purchase I'm going to make is a camera that works in extreme conditions, because I've learned how to do some diving.
Oh.
And I do like being on the boat, and I don't want to worry about the drop picture or whatever. So I feel like that's going to happen before I'm going to get a mirrorless camera. But yeah, those are cool.
The other thing I want to talk about is a movie that I saw just yesterday called Europa Report. It's a terrific little sci-fi thriller. It's stars Charlton Copley from District 9 and Michael Nyquist, who is the original lead in the original version of Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. It's basically about astronauts who go on a privately funded mission to Europa, which is one of the moons of Jupiter, to try and find extraterrestrial life. And they encounter something there that they did not expect, or a little bit more than they expected, I should say, without spoiling too much. It's a great little movie. It's very short. It's like less than 90 minutes long. But the key thing about this movie that really impressed me was its the verisimilitude, the faithfulness to scientific accuracy. It's one of those found footage movies where you see everything through the onboard cameras of the ship, and it looks like it really does feel like you're watching a documentary of an actual space flight to Europa, with all of the sort of technical details involved. So I got to hand it to the director, Sebastian Cordero, for the level of verisimilitude in the Europa Report. So that's my movie pick there for the week. All right, let's get into some of our headlines here. So first off, right off the gate, I want to talk about Dropbox. Wired's Marcus Wolfson reported about Dropbox's first developer conference. With 175 million users, Dropbox is at the top of the heap of cloud storage services. But what's next for their founders? Next level APIs. They want to be more than cloud sync storage. They want to become the spiritual successor to the hard drive. How are they doing that? They've got two features that they're introducing. Three features. Chooser and saver options, which are basically, they want to incorporate the ability to save to Dropbox in every application. And by doing that, and so they're working with developers to have that incorporated into every application. And then something called data stores, which allows apps to write data about themselves into Dropbox from one device and read that data onto another. I'm interested to get your take on this, Tosin, since you work for what would be considered a competing company, Box.
Sure. So I think in some regards we do compete. I think I do find the boxes probably a little bit more enterprise focused. But in terms of this, I definitely think this is the direction that cloud storage is proceeding, because really what, you know, from my experience, it's no longer about storage, because everyone, you know, storage has become a commodity and will become more so as more players enter in the field and as we progress technologically. Right now, it's really about what you can do with the data in there and collaboration around it. And so I think that's definitely a good move by Dropbox to open up their APIs and give a little bit more flexibility around them. I think it's definitely – it's a space that a lot of organizations do. And similarly, you know, Box has features to a certain magnitude where we have completely open APIs and allow developers to, you know, silo their data, really just getting it in the hands of people so that the primary focus is that so that you can get your work done anywhere and any time, right? Your data, it just exists in the cloud and applications can leverage that. So definitely a really good move by Dropbox. I think I would have to say, you know, Dropbox, Box, a lot of the companies like that really have an edge up on a lot of the older SaaS-based providers, primarily because they haven't invested as much. And I think that also becomes that same sort of innovator's dilemma that we have previously talked about, where they're now starting to progress into this space, but it may be a little too late. I think, you know, this is an advancement. I'd be actually curious to hear what you guys think.
Well, I mean, I like the fact that they've got some great quotes in this Wired article. Tom Cruise in Minority Report is not carrying a thumb drive or logging into Gmail to pick up his attachment, said Drew. You know, that's what Drew Houston, the CEO, said. Yeah. And he's totally right. The idea is that the data should be available to you at all times. I definitely find myself using my Dropbox account from my iPad or from my iPhone a lot more than I thought I would when I first picked up those apps. Like, what can you really do? I think with Office 365 being available on iOS, that might change that scenario a little bit. But I find that what Dropbox is doing is always a little surprising to me. I never thought that a company whose job was to sync up your, you know, the stuff you put in some folder in the cloud would have this many APIs, this many uses, this many functions. You get to IFTTT, if this then that, Google that if you don't know what it is. You get there, and the applications that I use that tie into Dropbox are extreme. You know, they're, you know, everything from every time someone tags me in Facebook, that picture gets put into my Dropbox account. To the idea that, you know, Dropbox will hold my music purchases from Amazon, so that I can later put them into my iTunes account, my iTunes you know, app, so I can sync them to my phone and stuff later for offline use. So they're really robust already. The idea, like, where do you go from there, though? Like, what does storage really have in mind for you? I think Box.com has already shown us what storage can do for the enterprise, but their real focus here is on the consumer. And it, obviously, you know, Dropbox has enterprise hopes and dreams. They bought Mailbox. They've got this idea about using this stuff in an exciting way. But I really think that what's interesting here is that they're saying we're at the developer level now. We want to chase down the mistake that Apple made with its iWork in the cloud, where you can use iCloud to hold some documents and you can use iCloud for all these kind of wishy-washy things, but iCloud doesn't really allow you to just go in and get stuff or just go in and put stuff in there. And they're like, you know what? We get that people want to be able to use to have Dropbox access in their apps. And they want to be able to use it without having to go in the file system. And so because of that, we're going to work with developers in order to pull that off. But at the same time, we're not going to stop you from doing the old school, you know, open up your file browser, get into Dropbox, move stuff around. So I like the fact that they're approaching it from both ways. And I think that if they can get developers on board, it's going to be great. I don't know if they'll be able to get Windows, Microsoft's Office on board, because they have their whole SkyDrive situation and they want to lock things down. And iWork, I don't know if they'll be able to get that on board. But there are plenty of applications out there that definitely take advantage of Dropbox. In fact, I use Trello at work to maintain my project flows. And Trello allows you to upload documents into that system, you know, directly from Dropbox or from the file browser, which is incredibly convenient. So the idea that they're doing this, they've got plans with Mailbox. I think this is interesting. This is great.
Yeah, and I think this is really what a lot of developers want.
Yeah.
So coming from my position here as a tech consultant at Box, I actually work with developers, and I work with a lot of enterprises on what they can do with our APIs and basically building their own unique ecosystem. And there's some really cool and awesome things that people have done. There's like tons of there are several, you know, large universities that have built their own applications that, as well as other organizations that build their own applications that leverage Box in the background, but you never know. There's actually a lot of other resources that you as an individual may use on your daily basis, but you have no clue that there's Box in the back end. Now,
That's key, you want to make sure that your stuff is in the back end, but you also want to make sure that people understand what your brand is, because that's how you grow your brand. So right. I think like this is interesting, because what happens, like, how do you maintain your dominance, or not maybe not your dominance, but your ascendancy in the cloud storage world? You make yourself you make yourself even more of an ingrained part of a user's experience by integrating into as many things as you can on the front end as well as on the back end.
Right.
And Box has done that with things like PhotoSync and a couple other apps that I find myself using.
Box Edit and all those other cool stuff.
Exactly. I can throw, you know, with PhotoSync, any photo on my phone gets thrown over to either my Box account or to my PC, no problem. Right. So,
Exactly. And I think that's really – developers desire this because it means they no longer have to think about maintaining that storage allocation. As long as that your APIs mm-hmm. are clear-cut and mm-hmm. simple put, I think – it's really you see the ecosystem really just exploding. Similarly, in a strange correlation, it's also similar to what you saw initially when you had developers building iOS apps. It's that sort of right. rampant growth, especially given that I'm pretty certain Dropbox's APIs are also freely available, similar to Box's. So. Kind of a cool time that we live in. So, looking forward to see what happens.
Same here. I think it's a whole paradigm shift in the way we think about storage, online storage. Let's move on here. Jay-Z's freshly dropped new album, Magna Carta Holy Grail, has been getting plenty of buzz. First of all, the story made history when Jay-Z became the first artist to go platinum before his record was released to the public. It's everywhere. The story's everywhere, but we found a good take from Lauren O'Neill at CBC News. Samsung paid Jay-Z $5 million to pre-release his new album, Magna Carta Holy Grail, via a free Android app. In exchange, users were asked to share access to their social media accounts, their phone calls, their GPS location, and more. On top of that, many people who did download the app, over 500,000 so far, according to Billboard, were reportedly upset to have received a clean edit of the record instead of the full explicit version. Others unable to access the album at all from the app due to technical difficulties. And according to internet security company McAfee, a new Android Trojan embedded in a pirated copy of the app is circulating as well. What do you think about this? What do you think about, first of all, distributing an album via an Android app and the loss of the privacy concerns about what that app wants from you in return for that music?
Well, first, there are some things about, oh, there was a pirated version of the app, there's this and that. To me, those are small things. Those are not big deals.
Aren't you glad to have an iPhone? I'm kidding.
Well, I mean, you can say you're glad to have an iPhone. I think, frankly, the idea of distributing media content through a mobile app is brilliant. Mobile is where things are going. People are using their mobile phones. Youngsters often have their mobile phone as their only internet connection. So that's huge, and I think that is the right way to do it. You also have like lots of control over your DRM if you're concerned with that kind of thing. Maybe people will pull the audio out of it, but it takes a lot of work and so on and so forth. So that's huge. I mean, let's face it. The guy made history. He was the first artist to go platinum before the record was officially sold. Samsung made a good deal. They were like, we'll give you $5 million. We get X amount of copies to distribute to people.
Yeah.
And the fact is, you know, what did Samsung want out of it? They wanted data. And people wanted this. You know, if you want this content and you don't want to spend greenbacks on it, then you're going to pay somehow, and it's through the data. Now, as cold and heartless as that may sound, I want to bring up one thing that really struck me as kind of awesome about this whole thing. In the last 10 years, between Facebook and Google and all and these other guys who like have all this data, there's been a lot of scrutiny from the press, there's been a lot of outrage from the people, to the point where these companies have gotten transparent with where your data is going. And the reason this is a big deal is because the situation with the Holy Grail album is a big deal, is because when people went to install the app, because of the transparency in Android, people were presented with the fact that they needed to give the app these permissions. I need to know your contacts. I need to know where you are. I need to know about your phone calls. I need to know all about you in order for you to get this. Is that worth the $10 for the album? For a lot of people, no. For a lot of people, sure, why not? I don't care. But the fact is, that was up there in your face. We talked a year or so ago about how Sony changed its privacy policy, and it did it underhandedly.
Right.
Did it without people really, really knowing what was up. And I argued that you're supposed to read your privacy policy. But the fact is, this app came down, and the privacy concerns were laid out bare in front of the user. And that's really cool. Just the other day, we were not talking about this week, but AT&T changed its privacy policy so that they could sell your anonymous usage statistics to advertisers if you have an AT&T account for your mobile phone or your tablet or whatever. That's weird. It's weird because you're already paying for your AT&T account. So it's not free like how Gmail is free. It's not free how like, you know, Google Calendar is free. And they're just using the data, and that's how you're paying for it. You're already paying for it, and they're using it. So that's one of the things where old school, you know, the older companies, the older ways of doing things are still present. But Google is doing the right thing by saying, hey, look, you're on our operating system. Let me tell you everything that's going to happen right here with this app, what it needs permission for you to do. And
right.
that to me is really exciting and tight and cool, the fact that you get that transparency.
Just quickly mentioning, you know, iOS, on the other hand, doesn't tell you that in your face to this magnitude when you're going through that installation. So
it doesn't say it up in your face when you install the app, but what it does do is if the app needs access to your contacts, you get a pop-up saying this wants access to your contacts. It wants access to your location. It wants access to your photos. It wants access to your whatever. I've never seen a call log thing. I don't know. But so iOS, it does take privacy seriously as well. It just does it in spurts instead of all up front. Google's situation is a lot more like the Facebook app situation where like, hey, this is what it's going to need access to. I guess all I'm saying is that both systems are good to the consumer, you know, when you look at it from the perspective of how privacy was dealt with online 10 years ago, 5 years ago, a year ago.
I guess there's a quick question. But for given that you were accessing the app initially, like apart from what Android had put into place, did Samsung mention anything, or did they just go under the assumption that they would leverage what Android
had? I think when
you
design for a platform, you understand what you have to write for what the platform is going to require, and the platform requires that you disclose what you're going to use, what data you're going to collect. So I think it's well within Samsung's rights to be like, we're going to write it by the book,
and not say any special clearances.
They didn't really have to, because
it's already there.
Exactly. The operating system is robust enough to take care of that for them. So, I don't know. I thought that this was an interesting thing. There's obviously this shows you can, if you're an artist and you're big enough, you can make a ton of cash by pre-releasing your album via this app situation, you know, getting $5 million off the bat. You know, that's great. And then on the other hand, if you're a consumer and you want something for free, know that it's not free.
Nothing's
free. You know, I actually first heard this this story from my girlfriend who sent me a link saying, hey, just remember, nothing's for free, because that's you know, your information is worth something. An advertiser wants to reach out to you and enlighten you about their product based on the fact that they think that you're interested in hip hop or Jay-Z or you listen at late at night or whatever. Or you call your mother a lot. Because they know all that.
My problem with that, with the whole issue, is that it was a trade-off. You know, the trade-off for receiving this album for free is that you have to accept it through this app. And I mean, am I old-fashioned for...
It's not free. It costs your information.
Am I old-fashioned for wanting to receive my digital music through just the music files themselves with as little DRM as possible?
But it's free, Andy. This is the cost. The cost is your information. It's free in terms of monetary cost, but you have to pay for it somehow. You use Google, you have to pay for it by giving your information. When you use... when you use anything out there, you have to pay for it somehow. It has to be paid for. Samsung has value in being able to sell information.
I think it's worth worth the $10 to not have my information.
And that is the decision that I would hope. Not to use a phrase from like politics, but like I am pro choice on that front. I want to make it. I would love it if the world were in a place where you understand that I can either get it by giving my information up and not taking anything out of my bank account, or I can spend my money on it and I can have it on my own terms.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's the situation that I think we need to present the world with today. This choice of how do you want you can get this content, but you're going to have to pay for it one way or another. Just choose which way is right for you. I think over time, many people will take the way that doesn't take the money out of their bank account. Especially when they're younger and they see less consequences in that. But I think that choice is something that Google made really apparent, and I'm pretty proud.
All right, let's move on here. This next story you brought to my attention, Dwayne, I'm hoping that you can explain it to me a little bit, because it's a little I'm a little fuzzy on what makes this so revolutionary.
A year ago, the beginning of 2012, more than a year ago, the Jobs Act was passed. We were still coming out of the recession. We still are coming out of the recession, and the idea was to kickstart the economy by making it easier to start new companies, hire people, get people working again, right? So you look at the success of something like Kickstarter, where new companies can thrive with initial investment, and you get excited about that. But the thing about Kickstarter is that it's not quite a straight up initial investment in the traditional term. You're backing a product. So the idea here is to get ready to kickstart everything. John Coetzer of VentureBeat, I don't know if I pronounced his name correctly, he reported that more than a year after the Jobs Act was signed into law by Obama, the SEC finally released new rules about fundraising communications for startups. When we say kickstarting, we mean that startups will now be able to advertise that they are fundraising. This differs from Kickstarter, because rather than asking followers to back a project, they can now let the world know that they're seeking general funding in their company. So the idea here is that before, you were never allowed to say, hey, look, I started a company. I'm going to buy advertising to say I need your help in funding my company. Not the project, but just the company on its own. One of the reasons why that's been illegal for a long time is because of things like Ponzi schemes and so on. You can say, I've got a company, put your money in it, and then you can run away. But we have a lot more transparency. We have the internet. We can tell how a company is doing really early on, and that allows us to do some more things. The second piece of this is allowing individuals who don't hit these high watermarks in terms of their finances to be able to invest. So just like how when you're donating to a campaign for like president or senator or whatever, there's a limit, like maybe $2,500. The SEC is going to make rules that basically say that for every individual in the country who doesn't have a net worth of over $500,000, you're limited to crowdfunding $2,500 a year to different startups. Now, the reason why they want to limit it is because they don't want you to take your entire salary, dump it in a bunch of startups, and then like be bankrupt. And you know, then the economy completely suffers because people aren't paying their bills, or you have to go on welfare or whatever. But they figure $2,500 is enough for anybody. To be able to get in, to be able to have some initial investment. And the companies that want to support, the companies that want to organize this investment and run this investment are there to basically, you know, there are these little financial companies that exist or that want to exist. They can't exist yet. And they basically want to do a Kickstarter-like situation where, you know, someone like Andy, you give $500 for this idea that you really like and you get a piece of equity and you get return on your investment. So instead of like the Pebble where you get a pebble and you're like, yay, I got a Pebble device, you get a return on your investment. You say, I agree that I'm going to put in $500, and in 3 years I'll be getting back $700, which is a significant percentage return on your investment. That's what they want to do across the board for startups across the country. This allows the power of 300 million pockets to spur and support innovation of several hundred thousand companies and move the economy up. Because as these companies grow, they start hiring people and so on and so forth. So it's a big deal for technology. The fact that the Jobs Act, Title II of the Jobs Act, gets this ability to basically be, startups begin to advertise that they need funding, and they're going to be reaching out to people for that. And then if you have money, and you're, even though you're not rich, you can become a part of a company on the ground floor. That's cool, because right now only really wealthy people can do that. Only really wealthy people can jump in with hedge fund type investments and support these companies. So that's the big deal here. So what do you guys think?
I'm curious to see. I cannot wait to see how this affects basically the ripple effect from coming off of this for startups.
Yeah, really quickly for me, on one hand, it's kind of interesting and cool to have this this ability for new innovative and unique things to spring up. On the other hand, there are a lot of startups that fail. There's a very small percentage that actually are successful, and I wonder, you know, how comfortable people will be, you know, with loss, right? How comfortable are you guys right now with if you had a Kickstarter which didn't get funded?
I've had that happen, but
never saw any return in investment.
Yes, I've had that happen to me, and I was very upset about that.
Yeah, luckily, the whole point here is that you can't – the rules are going to stop you from overextending yourself. One of the things the SEC has to put together, the Securities and Exchange Commission, is basically a big-ass list, a big-ass private list that shows whenever you invest, like you go through company A investment company A has 9 different startups, and you choose one and you want to give them $200. You're now on the list. You're ticked off $200. $200 is taken away from your $2,500 pool. And across all the different investment companies and all the different startups, you can only invest $2,500 a year, which means you can't. It's very difficult for you to go broke, right? You could lose $2,500. $2,500 that could have been in your Roth IRA or your 401k or whatever.
Right.
But it's unlikely that's going to put you in crazy. It's going to put you in a position where you can't pay your bills. So that's like the big trick. That's what's coming next. That's what they haven't figured out how to like logistically do yet. And I think you're right. It's disappointing when you invest in something and you don't get anything back. It's going to be a lot of work on these little investment firms that are going to be managing these startups and their investment futures to vet the startups appropriately and to accept only the startups that they think can return an investment properly to their companies. You know, to their investors. So, because they obviously, these little investment companies, they want someone like Tosin to be coming back to them, which means they have to go and find the best little startups out there to back, the ones that are going to survive and going to thrive and going to give Tosin the best return of his money, so Tosin comes back and they can get their cut. Mm-hmm. So the incentive, economically speaking, the incentive is there for everybody to do well. If the vetting, and if the companies continue to fail in one investment company, then that investment company goes belly up. But there's so many that there's no too big to fail investment company. You know, that's kind of cool. So,
all right, let's take a moment to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book I want to recommend this week is called I Wear the Black Hat, Grappling with Villains, Real and Imagined by Chuck Klosterman. In I Wear the Black Hat, Chuck Klosterman questions the very nature of how modern people understand the concept of villainy. What was so Machiavellian about Machiavelli? Why don't we see Batman the same way we see Bernard Goetz? Masterfully blending cultural analysis with self-interrogation and limitless imagination, I Wear the Black Hat delivers perceptive observations on the complexity of the antihero, seemingly the only kind of hero America still creates. So that book or any of Audible's other 100,000 plus titles can be yours for free, plus a 30-day trial to check out their services. And for that, go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook. If you don't like the book, if you don't like the service, you can still keep the book. If you don't like the book, you should have picked a better book. But if you don't like the service, you can cancel the service and you still get to pick. You still get to keep the audiobook for free. All right, we're going to take a little break here and listen to some music. And when we return, the NSA doesn't back down, it doubles down. Take a listen to this and come on back.
You take the clothes off my back and I let you. You'd steal the food right out my mouth and I'd watch you eat it. I still don't know why I love you so much. Oh, you curse my name in spite to put me to shame. Have my laundry in the streets, dirty or clean, give it up for fame. But I still don't know why I love it so much. Yeah. And baby, it's amazing I'm in this maze with you. I just can't crack your code. One day you're screaming you love me loud, the next day you're so cold. One day you're here, one day you're there, one day you care, you're so unfair. Sipping from your cup till it runneth over. Holy grail.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Duane DeFreitas and Tosin Onufowaken. The Obama administration in a new court filing urged the nation's surveillance court to throw out a request by the ACLU to disclose its secret rulings about the scope and legality of the Patriot Act. This comes to us via a GigaOM, Jeff John Roberts reported. So Obama administration says that the secret court does not have to publish its decisions about who gets surveilled and who doesn't.
So it's kind of interesting. It's like the ACLU challenged the secret nature of the decisions that this FISA court is making.
Yeah.
The FISA court is the court that it basically exists.
It makes
in the
shadows. Decisions of it basically decides who gets surveilled.
Exactly. And what happens is FBI or someone else shows up in front of the court and says, hey, look, we want to surveil this person. And the FISA court thinks about it. And what the court is it's a bunch of judges that have been chosen by the Chief Justice of the United States, John Roberts. He chooses them by himself unilaterally. He's a conservative and he chooses conservative judges. And these guys sit on the bench while they do their other duties. They sit on the bench. They meet and they do this cloak and dagger clandestine court. Okay, yeah, you can look at this guy. You can look at that guy. Okay, sure, okay. That's what they do. So the ACLU is like, hey, who are you surveilling? Like, why? Like, I mean, just like, what's up? And the Obama administration was like, well, or the Justice Department is going to defend the court and everything else and say that they don't have to say anything. So it's kind of a little painful. It's a little it's a little strange coming from an American perspective. So I think that's that to me is what stands out here.
Once again, it all falls under the clause of national security. It's okay to do if it's in the name of national security. Which just frustrates me to no end. On top of this other report about this coming from Tikkun Daily, and the reporter there was David Harris Gershon, who is – well, let me give you a little backstory. Let me quote a little bit from that article. Clayton Seymour, a 36-year-old IT specialist from Ohio, recently sent a Freedom of Information Act request to the NSA, curious as to whether any data about him was being collected. What he received in response was a letter that acknowledges the media coverage surrounding the surveillance systems, but quickly moves to justify why none of that data can be obtained by an American citizen in a standard Freedom of Information Act.
I think the quote was, "Your request is denied because the fact of the existence or non-existence of responsive records is currently properly currently and properly classified matter." So basically, this guy's like, "Hey, so do you have any? Are you surveilling me?" And they're like, "I'm sorry, sir. We can't tell you because that's classified. It's classified for me to know whether or not you're surveilling me." "Yes, sir." That's really what it's come down to. Basically, they're in a quandary of law here, I guess, is what's going on. Just in terms of like the tech processes behind this, the court is secret by law.
Yeah.
So what it does is secret by law. And the fact that Edward Snowden broke open the secret doesn't mean the actual laws around it were changed. So while it's been acknowledged because Snowden said, "Guys, this is happening," the people who run the court and who run these programs are like, "Yeah, yeah, it's happening. Put a lid on it." So if someone asks about their own stuff, they have to basically – the rank and file people who are administering it have to by law say, "Okay, I can't pretend it doesn't exist, but you can't know anything about it because it's a secret."
So does that mean that my own personal information is classified? No, it doesn't mean that. It means
they can't tell you whether or not they're surveilling you.
Exactly.
It means no one in the country can know whether or not they're being surveilled, even though the surveillance is supposed to be on people who are outside of the country.
Yeah.
That becomes an issue.
Right. The NSA, it seems, has classified every single piece of data on American citizens it seized and saved, even benign data culled from average citizens who are no threat to U.S. national security.
Yeah, and it's taken that data and said, "Yeah, it's all about us, guys. We can't tell you. We can't even tell you about yourself because that could represent a problem." And maybe it could.
But the fact is, there's all this data out there about like you that random companies have. And the NSA has been holding on to it indefinitely, and they have to determine whether you're a national security risk, and that's weird. It's weird.
Do you think at any point within the next month or so that we'll hit like a peak where we've maximized the outrage, or do you think it's just going to continue being this?
I mean, people get tired. You can't throw a tantrum forever. That's what you learn when you have kids. They throw a tantrum on the floor. You get a little upset about it. But the fact is, they can't stay that angry for a long time. I think that they're probably the people behind this situation are going to try to blow it over as soon as they can. I think they're going to try to focus on Edward Snowden as a traitor. And it's going to be very difficult. But I mean, the sad thing is, it flies in the face of, I think, what we think this country's about. Regardless of how you feel about, security and all these things, the idea that like this has been blown wide open and you can't find out about yourself is a little painful. Now, if you're a terrorist and you ask to find out about yourself, the government's, I can see you might, the argument might be made, well, if you're a terrorist and you're asking what they know about you, then you'll find a better way not to be caught about it. But then if you're a terrorist and you're trying to hide, you're not going to reach out to the government asking if they know anything about you, or maybe you would. The idea is that it's a little strange, it's a little weird, especially in light of the way that this administration, the Democratic president, who's focused on transparency and freedom of information and all this stuff, has presented himself. In fact, I think now would be a good time to just have a reminder of what Obama said back when he got elected, when he first started being president in 2009.
Should we remind the people what he said?
Roll the YouTube.
Let's go to the tape.
"The way to make a government responsible is not simply to enlist the services of responsible men and women or to sign laws that ensure that they never stray. The way to make government responsible is to hold it accountable. And the way to make government accountable is to make it transparent so that the American people can know exactly what decisions are being made, how they're being made, and whether their interests are being well served. The directives I am giving my administration today on how to interpret the Freedom of Information Act will do just that. For a long time now, there's been too much secrecy in this city. The old rules said that if there was a defensible argument for not disclosing something to the American people, then it should not be disclosed. That era is now over. Starting today, Every agency and department should know that this administration stands on the side not of those who seek to withhold information, but those who seek to make it known. To be sure, issues like personal privacy and national security must be treated with the care they demand. But the mere fact that you have the legal power to keep something secret does not mean you should always use it. The Freedom of Information Act is perhaps the most powerful instrument we have for making our government honest and transparent, and of holding it accountable. And I expect members of my administration not simply to live up to the letter, but also the spirit of this law. I will also hold myself as president to a new standard of openness. Going forward, anytime the American people want to know something that I or a former president wants to withhold, we will have to consult with the Attorney General and the White House counsel, whose business it is to ensure compliance with the rule of law. Information will not be withheld just because I say so. It will be withheld because a separate authority believes my request is well-grounded in the Constitution. Let me say it as simply as I can. Transparency and the rule of law will be the touchstones of this presidency.
That is a 180-degree difference from what we've got going on today.
It's a powerful speech by a person who just got elected and had the best of intentions, and then you're right, it's blown wide open by the fact that we've got a 36-year-old IT guy trying to find out through Freedom of Information requests what's up. We've got the ACLU trying to use Freedom of Information requests, and we've got the president's own administration, that same guy you just heard, saying, nope, gotta protect it, gotta keep it on the lockdown. So in terms of how, I don't know about you guys, but I remember when Obama first showed up, he was like, I'm going to use technology. That's why it's so relevant to what we're talking about today, in order to make sure things are clean and open, in order so you can see how budgets are being spent, how we're defending you, what's up with, you know, privacy and all this other stuff like that. And here we are several years later, and it's not really happening. So I would say that I'm disappointed. And it's just food for thought.
Yeah, it's really sad to see such a reversal or change. I think, you know, one of my hope was that, you know, in light of what was previously said, that, you know, maybe he would take a step back and, I think he would take a step back and maybe apologize is what we're looking for, or maybe at least try to change
clarify
policy.
It.
Right the ship. Clarify is probably a better mechanism, but I don't know if currently it doesn't look like we're going to be getting that anytime soon. So.
Right. So the big question is how the courts, this FISA court, how did it get to a point where it could make these crazy decisions about who gets surveilled and who doesn't, right? Like, and basically they're like, okay, the big deal here is that the NSA was working with the telecom companies to track everybody's stuff. And they were like, okay, well, if you guys aren't going to hold the data more than X amount of days, we'll hold the data. Because if we hold all the data and don't use it, then everything's fine. But the fact is, when we have to find something out, we need a set of data to look at. I think the phrase was, you can't connect the dots without the dots. And so that's a big sea change from what the original Patriot Act said that they were able to do. The original Patriot Act said that the NSA was able to collect relevant information. And basically, I think what we're finding is that, you know,
the NSA collects all information and then determines whether or not it's relevant after the fact.
Exactly. The FISA court managed to change the definition of relevant.
Yes.
This lady, Jennifer Valentino DeVries, she reported for the Wall Street Journal that change in that one redefinition of the word relevance is what made PRISM this number of surveillance techniques that we're calling PRISM possible. The idea that they can change the word relevance from everything is relevant to everything is relevant from, oh, we think this person might be janky, we want to look into them, rubber stamp, go. It's now everything's relevant, so you can look into it later. This is a place where the rule of law kind of falls apart, because we're taught that that laws were passed by Congress. You know, we've all seen Schoolhouse Rock, or maybe you're too young to have seen it, but it's on YouTube. I'm only a bill, and I'm sitting here on Capitol Hill. It goes either through the Senate first or through the House first, and then it goes into the other chamber. And once it gets all good, it's all ready, it goes to the president, and the president signs it. That's not how laws are made in the FISA court, because when the FISA court changes a word like relevance, it changes the law. It says that the law of the land allows for the NSA to copy every single thing, all the metadata from your phone calls, this Skype call that we're on, everything. And that's weird. That's weird, and you know, it's strange, and it's uncomfortable, I think. So, yeah, I don't know. I feel like hearing what these reporters like, you know, Eric Lichtbau from The Times and Jennifer Valentino DeVries said, just makes it so that you realize the technology that we use is being completely used against us. And that's uncomfortable.
I have to say at least that just speaking from a reporting standpoint, that I'm really impressed with the work that the New York Times is doing on this subject, with the both the editorials and the investigative reporting that they've been doing. And I know it's kind of a it's kind of an obvious thing to say that the New York Times has good reportage, but they're really above and beyond.
And it's not easy. I mean, we know that the whistleblower laws that are were made enacted by this administration screwed up people they screw up people. You look at people who have used these whistleblower laws to blow off things like this, and they always end up like either in jail or in debt. So then you have this Snowden guy. Is he a traitor or isn't he? I don't know the answer, but I do know that his blowing up this issue, combined with tried and true reporters from New York Times, Wall Street Journal, even Tikkun, all these places, they're showing us what's going on behind the scenes in a way that they've been trained to do. And we're lucky that we do live in a country where we have a press that can get access to that. I mean, you go look at Egypt right now, you don't have that. And the press is making use of the same technology. So it really comes down to like the way our society is dealing with this tech, the ability to copy everything, the ability, you know, Edward Snowden copied all these documents and like put them out there. Meanwhile, the government's copying everything we're doing and data mining it. Information is everything, literally.
I'm going to quote a little bit from this New York Times report article, because I really love the way that they've worded it here. The 11-member FISA court was once mostly focused on approving case-by-case wiretapping orders, but since major changes in legislation and greater judicial oversight in intelligence operations were instituted 6 years ago, it has quietly become almost a parallel Supreme Court, serving as the ultimate arbiter on surveillance issues and delivering opinions that will most likely shape intelligence practices for years to come. Unlike the Supreme Court, the FISA court hears from only one side in the case, the government, and its findings are almost never made public. In fact, it's not clear in all circumstances whether internet or phone companies that are turning over the reams of data even have the right to appear before the FISA court. So they have just this unrestrained ability to make decisions without any basic checks and balances. As an ordinary citizen whose data is part of this pool of data that's being scrutinized by the NSA, it's very frustrating to know that they're holding on to this data just because it may be relevant at some time in the future, at some unknown time in the future.
It's a strange conflict. I mean, at the same I don't disagree with you, but at the same time, they're like, look, if some shit's about to go down, we need to be able to mine for this shit. I think for me, the big thing is that I'd actually be way more cool with it if we all knew it was happening. Does that mean that we'd behave a little differently? Maybe. But we wouldn't behave so differently that it wouldn't be effective to maintain all the data anyway. You look at like simple things like the CD sounded better than the MP3, but the MP3 was way more convenient, so we used it. The fact is, I could write a letter to you right now, or I could send you an email. The email is way more efficient. So if they're going to be tracking who I'm sending email to, who I'm calling, things like that, I'm still going to do it. And that matters. So I don't know. I think that the thing about privacy is not that everything's confidential. The thing about privacy is that you trust who has your stuff and what they're using it for. And if there was a slight bit more transparency in terms of like the use of the word relevant, the collection of all this data, how it's being used, just an admonition that the government's watching, we would all respect that.
Hmm. With great power comes great responsibility, right?
Yeah. I mean, this goes to show, I think it was Firefly had this great, Shepard Book had this great quote that government is by definition a group of people who are ungoverned. And based on the president's previous exclamation that he was going to be transparent and based and allow for Freedom of Information Act to be used as the tool it was meant to be used for in the spirit of what it was meant to be used for and the actions his administration are taking now, I really feel like that lack of governance, the fact that they are ungoverned people is there. You know, this doesn't say that, you know, George W. Bush didn't have the same issue. But he never did say, I want super transparency. And that's where the problem comes in.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. Any last words on the NSA watch for this week? And, you know, I would hate for, I'm trying for this not necessarily to be a weekly segment, but it continues to be relevant. And as long as it's relevant, I feel that we should report on it. As long as there is newsworthy issues involved in this, I feel we should report on this.
We're supposed to drill down into what matters in news and technology. Yeah. This is what matters in technology.
Absolutely. We're going to take another break here, and when we return, good news from the iPhone App Store and for all app stores in general. So take a listen to this and come on back.
Keep our business to yourself. Please, darling, do me a favor. Keep our business to yourself. I don't want you to tell nobody in your family, and don't mention it to nobody else. Don't tell your mother, don't tell your father, don't tell your sister, don't mention it to your brother. Please, darling, keep our business to yourself. Don't you tell nobody, and don't mention it to nobody else.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom. I'm Andy Sarsini, and I'm here with Duane DeFreitas and Tosin Onifowakin. Apple and Amazon have ended their lawsuit over who has the right to use the App Store name, clearing the way for both companies to use it. So, you remember when this lawsuit first came about and Apple wanted a lock on the App Store as a trademark? And Amazon claimed, well, you can't use that general term and claim it as a trademark because all stores are app stores.
Yeah, well, it's this idea that there's like an application store, right. A place where you can buy your applications. Amazon came out with the Kindle Fire and they were like, we have an app store too. With our forked version of Android, you go to the Amazon app store, you download stuff. Apple has always called its location for downloading mobile apps, quote, the app store,
right?
Unquote. The idea being that they are the central location. They then came out with the Mac app store. Apple's always called its stuff apps. It's kind of a play on the idea of application, the fact that they're called Apple. And Apple said, this is a trademark of ours. We've trademarked it a long time ago. The app store is ours. The idea of the app is ours. Amazon's confusing people. Amazon's saying they're the app store and we're the app store.
Right.
This was a highly ideological situation that may or may not have come out of the mind of Steve Jobs. It's a fight for this word,
yeah,
the app store.
Yeah, I think
store.
You're right. I think that's probably where it originated.
It was just one of those choices. And it looks like today they settled out of court, or yeah. not today, but they recently settled out of court, and Apple backed up and said, it's not worth us fighting
right.
for this use of the term App Store. Everybody knows who we are. You know, we've got 50 billion downloads. We've been around for 5 years.
Yeah.
There are no hacked versions of apps in our store. We are the center of this mobile world as far as we're concerned. Amazon can put their name in front of the term App Store, and it's not going to affect us. I mean, that's the reasoning that had to have happened on the Apple side.
It wasn't worth
right. Apple going toe-to-toe with a company that's almost as big as they are and suffering from a PR perspective for an issue that seemed relatively trivial and silly.
It's basically a battle that Steve Jobs wanted to pick and Tim Cook did not want to pick that battle. And I think he made the right decision. I think it's interesting in the court documents for this that Amazon, part of their case against Apple was that both Tim Cook and Steve Jobs had used the term App Store generically when talking about all the different app stores, the number of app stores out there, the 4 app stores on Android.
And that's powerful. The idea that you're Tim Cook and you're sitting in, you know, All Things D or some other interview. And you say, oh, there are plenty of app stores, but our app store is the best. That clearly shows that the genericized term means that someone else can call them their stuff. Now,
right. That
said, you don't see Puff's company calling their tissues Kleenex, right?
Right.
So I don't know if that's enough. You don't see companies that make insulated bottles calling themselves Thermos, you know?
Right. Like how much does that hold up in court?
Exactly. So, I mean, it's an argument. I don't know if it's like an argument that that holds real water to lean on that Thermos analogy. So it's just interesting. I think in the end, it's a waste of money.
Because the world isn't
going to be swayed by the fact that you call yourself the App Store and nobody else does. Because the term is genericized, people are going to go over to the Amazon store and be like, oh, it's an App Store.
The consumer is better served by the companies saving that money from this lawsuit and spending it on other things. Like
anything else.
Like giving people free apps, for example. In honor of its 5th anniversary, Apple's App Store is giving away some of its most popular games and apps for free. I don't know what it's a limited time. I'm not sure what the limit of the time is. I'm guessing at least a week, maybe a month. In any case, head over to the App Store on your iPhone or iPad, and you'll find a 5 years of the App Store banner with details on the apps and games available. There are 5 apps and 5 games. The apps are Barefoot World Atlas, Day One, How to Cook Everything, Over, and Tractor DJ. And the games are Badland, Infinity Blade 2, Super Brothers Sword and Sorcery EP, Tiny Wings, and Where's My Water? It feels like there's more than... Was that 6? 6 games that I just listed?
I think it may have been. I think the thing about this seems that these games, like, you would think that like Angry Birds would be on here.
Yeah.
But it's not.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons why it's not is because Angry Birds is available on multiple platforms. These other games are not. These games are exclusive to the App Store, and that's one of the criteria, it seems, to be able to have this this level of support from Apple.
I have to say, my best advice is, even if you don't have the space on your iPad or iPhone, just get the license for these anyway, because it's free. And I'm going to tell you a couple of these. Like Tractor DJ, I had been hemming and hawing about buying for a long time. But the thing that had held me off is that it's $20, $20 app. So this is a $20 app that they're giving away for free for this limited time. And it's totally worth it if you want to explore a little DJ action there.
Yeah, I downloaded quite a few myself. I've played Sword and Sorcery. I've played a little bit of that on PC through Steam. And so I thought, hey, since I've never completed it, might as well get it for a mobile device. Infinite Blade 1, I don't know if I've touched the second one, was one of the most graphically intense games for
That's an interesting game. That was the first sort of like super 3D intense game.
Infinity Blade 2
is
even better.
You build up all this stuff in the first Infinity Blade,
yeah.
And then they have a new one. You got to start all over again. So all your in-app purchases are like not there. It was
but
a little painful.
Like they exponentially improved on the graphics and every other aspect in Infinity Blade 2. This is another game that I was, you know, hemming and hawing over buying.
$7, yeah.
$7, for free, it's totally worth it. And it's the graphic quality on this game is incredible. I mean, mm-hmm. it's totally worth getting just for that alone. Barefoot World Atlas.
Yeah, I picked that one up too.
It's like,
as well as How to Cook.
How to Cook Everything. Barefoot World Atlas is like a gig in of storage. So you know you need to have a gig available on your iPad, but it's vast. It's worth it. It's great for kids if you're just introducing them to sort of like the World Atlas thing. Great graphics, nice little capsule definitions on just about every sort. It's like Encarta, you know, 21st century Encarta. So if Encarta
and
means
Badlands, that's another game in there. It's a very different type of game. It's got these creepy silhouettes of rabbits in the background, and it has like it's like a one push, like you just push the screen, and it's really intuitive. It's also really intense and addictive, and that's another game that I feel like doesn't have the press that Infinity Blade has or Sword and Sorcery has, but is an innovative game that's iOS only. And really shows off the power of iOS.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, for a limited time, like I said, I don't know how long that limited time is. Apple doesn't mention it on their site, but it's totally worth it. All right, let's talk about the last headline here before we talk about our the drill down video of the week. In a sweeping rejection of Apple's strategy for selling ebooks on the internet, a federal judge ruled that the company conspired with major publishers to raise ebook prices. We talked about this story a while back when the suit was first being raised. Did they or didn't they? And now it's determined that a judge has ruled that there's compelling evidence that Apple violated federal antitrust law by playing a central role in a conspiracy with publishers to eliminate retail price competition and raise ebook prices. Apple was accused of conspiring to undercut Amazon's ebook dominance, causing some ebook prices to rise to $12.99 or $14.99 from the $9.99 that Amazon charged. At the time, Amazon had a 90% market share. So this does not surprise me because we've seen Apple do this before with movies and with music, and so
I don't know. Price fixing is different. We don't see like Department of Justice inquiries into iTunes the way we saw it into these books. Basically, Apple tried to strong arm many of these companies, and the companies were like these publishers, and the publishers were like, "Yeah, I want to get over on Amazon. Sure, we're gonna make it so that these prices reflect what we want, not what the market can bear. And we're gonna do it in an artificial way, and we're gonna do it because Steve Jobs is forcing us to do it in some respect. Get on the boat or get off. He's got this iPad; it's selling wildly, and this is the future of publishing, and there's all that hype. And basically." Whether they were seduced by the devil and Steve Jobs or they went willingly, they decided to – not that he's a devil, but there's a devil in him, right?
Sure.
Not that – you know, they decided to go ahead and fix prices, to collude together to take advantage of the consumer, and that's what's wrong here. When Steve Jobs and the company pulled together the iTunes store and started selling music for a dollar, they got in with everybody. There's competition all around. The world was done in CDs, and you know the app store, the iTunes store was breaking new ground. But when it comes to these books, there existed e-publishers. There existed a market for e-books, and Apple decided to get into that market. They were going to change the game by playing against typical business rules, and you know. That's the thing. So when you look at the three stories about Apple in this final word, you see that there's this issue with Apple and Amazon and the name App Store, which got resolved so everyone can use the name App Store. You see this cool thing about 50 billion downloads. And you see this other thing about how the DOJ says that Apple – there's compelling evidence against Apple in terms of price fixing, which is a no-no. Two out of these three things were heavy Steve Jobs ideological things.
Yeah.
So this is not helping his legacy.
You know what it is? The takeaway that I get from this ebook story is that Apple, at least at the time that they had engaged in these practices, felt that they had the audacity. They had the audacity to feel that they could engage in the price fixing without any remorse, without any sort of compunction. Like, they felt that they could do it and get away with it.
Yeah, I think that's a big thing. They also feel like, you know, the iTunes store, again, complete innovation. The App Store, innovation. The iBook store, it's an iterative thing. It's a thing like the swipe down for Notification Center. That's a thing that existed in Android. The iBook store, that's a thing that existed on Amazon. It's a thing where they're like, we want to get into that business. What do we have to do to do it? We're going to use our purchasing power and our market power to get into it in a meaningful way. I don't care who I have to step on or what I have to do in order to become a part of that. And that was a problem.
What changes do you think will come out of this lawsuit?
I think it's unclear. Apple's still looking to clear their name, so to speak. Now, does it really matter? Are people looking at this and being, oh man, I'm not going to buy an Apple product because of this iBook situation? That's not going to happen. Apple is going to be fine. In fact, the less they hem and haw and make noise about this, the better it is for everyone involved, because people will forget about it. But I think it is going to make sure that – it's going to help ensure that people are getting reasonable prices for ebooks. I mean, the idea of paying $16 for an electronic book that has no binding, no paper, didn't involve any shipping – that's weird when the actual physical book costs $16. Now, I know people will say, well, the prices, you know, economies of scale, the price isn't in the materials, it's really in the development. But as a consumer, it seems strange to me to spend $16 on a book that is only an email base. It's text.
Yeah.
You know? So.
All right. Let's talk about this, the drill down video of the week. Which is the first gameplay video for Rockstar's Grand Theft Auto V. This is an amazing... Okay, all right. You criticized me before we started the show about using the word amazing. I don't know how to put it. For someone who's followed Rockstar's the GTA series from game one, I started following GTA at game three, from game three on. But... for those of you who have gone back that far with Rockstar, to see the progress that they've made in GTA 5 is just – it's phenomenal. They have created this immersive world where virtually anything is possible in a world that's so realistic, has such – I mean, it's just so textured, detailed. This video – also, I have to point out that this video is unlike any video that I've ever seen Rockstar release, in that it's a comprehensive breakdown of how GTA 5 works, whereas before the videos for their games have been more thematic or more showcasing the story element. But this one is an actual breakdown of the gameplay of GTA 5, which is a different approach for Rockstar. What did you guys think of this video?
The video is pretty impressive. You know, of course, the first thing we notice is graphically that it's a progression forward, but they always are. So Rockstar always delivers. But I think where they've tried to push the bounds a little bit more is a more interconnected, intertwined story and different and allowing your characters to have different roles, different complete lives. So rather than segmenting them into specific pieces where you can only semi-interact with the world when it comes with, you know, finding vehicles, flying around, getting in the way of people, now you can actually do fun things with people, natural, like realistic things, kind of like The Sims, right? I mean, The Sims don't go to this extent, but it's a progression of that where you're able to go biking, you're able to go diving, just like normal everyday elements that don't necessarily revolve around revolve around the main game objectives, right, or even, you know, like committing crimes, I guess.
I think when I saw like that you could play golf, you could do deep sea diving, hunting. It's like a bunch of you know, these are all games that you would play, you would pay separate, you know, prices for and get separate full games in, and they're all bundled together in this one experience, a sort of life experience of the GTA world, which, you know, GTA kind of hinted at in previous versions, but here they've really gone all out.
Yeah, it's truly impressive, and for me, I was not at all compelled for another GTA game, primarily because I don't really have that much time to dedicate towards gaming, and this actually piqued my interest, made me want to hear more about it, and maybe even want to experience it when it comes out. So that's good props to them.
Yeah, for me, the only real sort of question in my mind is, do I go out and get the PS3 version when the game is first launched, or do I wait another 6 months or so for the inevitable PC version, which at this date has not yet been announced?
Yeah. As well as multiplayer.
Yes. Oh, right. Multiplayer. I'm not a huge multiplayer person, so I'm okay without that experience. But for sure, I love the. I mean, this sounds like the kind of game that I will spend literally months on just the single player, just the campaign version. As an example, I'm still not done with Skyrim. So, I mean, there you go.
Well, that is. Skyrim is a lifestyle. That's
exactly
that's for sure.
That feels like Rockstar feels like they're really getting into that. I'm not going to say for the first time ever, because I felt like Red Dead Redemption was kind of the first game to really get into the immersive lifestyle style gameplay. But this one really takes it to the limit. All right, I'm going to go around the table here, and I'm going to start with you, Dwayne. Where can we find your work online when you're not here on the Drill Down?
You can always find me on Twitter, twitter.com/DwayneD. That's DwayneD. And you can find everything I do at flavors.me/DwayneD, DwayneD. And you can always find me here on the Drill Down.
Tosin, how about yourself? Where can we find your work online when you're not on the Drill Down?
You can find me at twitter.com/toast4321. You can also find me and random mumblings at ircwebcast.blogspot.com.
As for myself, you can find me at mrbabyman.com, or you can always catch me on twitter.com and facebook.com, again at mrbabyman. Look me up on the Googles, you'll find me. If you've got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about, tweet us or email us at comments@thedrilldown.com. If you've got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on the site. You can always let the Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our amazing audience. There, said it, amazing. Write to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. Oh, we're not going to be here next week because I'm going to be at Comic-Con, but you can catch the stories that I contribute to geeksofdoom.com on the site under Mr. Babyman, and just follow our Geeks of Doom's Comic-Con coverage in general, and you'll see like the latest from all the panels and Hall H. Catch us the following week at the same time and location, and that's it for this episode of the Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.